read from Bhagavad Gita as it is. Translation and purports, of course, of Ashoka Prabhupada. And Gangaya has selected a verse from chapter 4, text 38. Begin. So the Sanskrit for this text is Nahi Jnanena Sadrasham Avitraniya Vidyate Tatsvayam Yoga Sansiddha Kalenatmani Vindati. Translation: in this world, nothing is so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge is the mature fruit of all mysticism. And one who has become accomplished in the practice of devotion and service enjoys this knowledge within himself in due course of time. So Prabhupada's one paragraph purport for this verse. When we speak of transcendental knowledge, we do so in terms of spiritual understanding. As such, there is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Ignorance is the cause of our bondage, and knowledge the cause of our liberation. This knowledge is the mature fruit of devotional service, and when one is situated in transcendental knowledge, one need not search for peace elsewhere, for one enjoys peace within oneself. In other words, this knowledge and peace culminate in Krishna consciousness. That is the last word of the Bhagavad Gita. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Desha Tarine. So this verse comes in a section of the Bhagavad Gita toward the end of chapter 4, which Krishna talks about knowledge. The Sanskrit word here, of course, is jnana, which is one of the few words in Sanskrit not pronounced as it's written, since it's J-N. So, I remember at the university, some, I guess, phonetic purists would say jnana, which doesn't sound so good, that's probably why people don't say it. Anyway, this word jnana is, of course, cognate with, it's related to the Greek word gnosis. We have words like gnostic or agnostic, and so on. So let's look at this section of the Bhagavad Gita. I want to put this verse in context, because Krishna talks about knowledge, the importance of knowledge. Interestingly, this it's a very interesting section. So it really goes all the way back to why don't we start at text 32? And then this is 38, so because it's all part of this interesting discussion, which goes up to the end of the chapter, up to 42. So it's really like about 11 verses. The context is that Krishna has been talking in this chapter about sacrifice, yajna, sacrifice, which means in the sense of making an offering. Now, sacrifice, the Sanskrit word is yajna, or yagya, or jaga, different regional pronunciations in India, but written yajna. This sacrifice is very important because Krishna explains in chapter 3, still a few good seats left. Krishna explains in chapter 3 of the Bhagavad Gita that, to quote him, yagyartha karmano anyatra loko yam karma bandhana, which literally means that apart from work or action performed for sacrifice, you do something as an offering to God, apart from that kind of work, loko yam karma bandhana, which literally...
Sorry.
But it's a delightful ringtone. Krishna says, loko yam karma bandhana, which means, literally, this world, I am loka, this world is karma bondage. Karma bandhana. This world is karma bondage. That's all that's going on down here. Is that people are entangling themselves in different ways in these laws of karma and thinking that they're enjoying it. It's like, I guess, like the birdman of the Mahatma, the birdman of Alcatraz. It's like people, sometimes, you know, some people sort of find their niche in prison, which is whatever. But, so really that's all that's going on down here is this bondage. And then, so the idea here is that the only way to get out of karma, the only way to do something, to do anything, which is not going to provoke in the universe a reaction, which is going to then entangle you within matter. I mean, being entangled in matter, it's like the ultimate glue or molasses. It's like, you know, falling into a big pot of glue or something. In that we are down here in the material world, and we are pure spiritual beings. We are divine, enlightened, beautiful spiritual beings who are just kind of trapped in all these intricacies, this network, the spider's web or whatever, of matter, dead matter. We get a material body, this, as I said, virtual reality machine. We get this material body, and then driven by the desires and aversions of the body, in other words, we're chasing some things and we're running away from other things, and we're producing more karma, and this pulls us into another material body, and we're just thrashing around here in matter. So Krishna says the only way to get out of this, the only way to do something which will not react upon you, which will not provoke a karmic reaction, is that you must do whatever you do, not selfishly. And as Prabhupada always pointed out, there's individual and extended selfishness. For example, I could say, I'm just doing it for myself, period, or I'm doing it for my country, or something with which I identify. Anything which falls into this us and them thing is basically mundane. In other words, my country, if I say I'm an American, I mean, technically I'm an American, but what about Canadians? What about Mexicans? What about Ethiopians? So all these different designations that separate me, like I belong to this group, and then all those other people, they're kind of like, you know, they're the out group and we're the in group. Remember that song from the 60s, I'm In with the In Crowd, by Dobie Gray? Maybe it was a popular song in the 60s. So that's the idea, you know, the in group and the out group. So any way of talking which really establishes an in group and an out group is probably mundane. Now, we of course talk about devotees and non-devotees. So are we also falling into a type of material duality? And the answer is yes, unless we remember that actually everyone is ultimately spiritually equal. In other words, we bring to Krishna consciousness a conditioned psychology in which in different ways we have different us and them schemes. Whether it's nationalism, or some people think that I belong to the really cool group that's not into nationalism. I mean, so you can approach it from any angle. There's all kinds of elite groups, whether it's the elite group that has more money, or the elite group that doesn't care about money, or whatever, there's like many different ways of feeding one's vanity. And even being a devotee, like I'm a devotee and those are not devotees, so I'm enlightened and they're not, that can become a vanity. So we have to cultivate this humility of remembering that actually everyone is equally part of Krishna and everyone is equally dear to Krishna. But in any case, sacrifice, doing something not for myself nor for some mundane collectivity, some mundane group that I identify with, but really doing it for Krishna, seeing Krishna as the source of and the as the source of all beings. So that by doing something for Krishna, I'm consciously acting for the good of all living things. So this kind of activity called yajna or sacrifice is the only kind of activity which will not bind us to the material world. So that Krishna explained in chapter 3, that verse. And then in chapter 4, he again picks up this, he returns to this topic of sacrifice and talks a lot about it, talks a lot about that, and he actually describes different kinds of sacrifices. He sort of gives a little sacrificial menu in the sense that there is the original sort of physical, classical sacrifice where you actually ignite a fire and you pour ghee or some oblation into the fire and make offerings and chant mantras, the old-fashioned fire sacrifice. But when Krishna speaks the Gita, he explains that the physical fire sacrifice, offering some physical element or substance into the fire, is merely a, it's almost like a symbolic structure which can be applied in many different ways. Like, for example, Krishna says that the senses can be the fire and the sense objects can be the offering. In other words, when sensations, visual or audible, when all the different sense impressions come into our mind, we can offer them into the mind, taking the mind to be Krishna's energy. Or we can offer the mind... The sense objects and the senses offer the senses to the mind. There's all kinds of offerings you can do, meditational offerings, internal offerings that don't necessarily involve external paraphernalia. So Krishna goes through this little summary of sacrifice, explaining so we get the idea of what he means by sacrifice. Anyway, after going through that topic, then he makes an interesting statement which is going to launch Krishna into another discussion. He's going to launch himself. No one's launching him. So Krishna says, Evam bahuvidho, evam bahuvidha yagya vitata brahmano mukhe. Thus, these sacrifices of many types, bahuvidha, these sacrifices of many types, vitata, are expanded. Brahmano mukhe, literally in the face of the Vedas. So it's sort of a poetic, elegant way of saying in Sanskrit that the Vedas have authorized all these different sacrifices. And then he says, here's the interesting point. Karma jan viditan sarvan even gyatva vimokshase. Know that all of them literally are born of this little Sanskrit suffix ja, born. It's a very common way of, in Sanskrit, of saying something's produced from something else or comes from something else. So Krishna says that all these sacrifices of various types are born of action. And he's trying to show Arjuna that you cannot achieve liberation, you cannot liberate yourself unless you make offerings and sacrifice. Hare Krishna. And any kind of offering you want to make requires you to do something. You have to be active. You can't just do nothing and make a sacrifice. You have to offer sacrifice to get out of the material world. And so you have to be active in this world. You actually have to do things in the world. But then Krishna says, know that all these sacrifices are born of work, and even gyatva, thus knowing, you will be liberated. Now, it's interesting about this little phrase here at the end of verse 432. Even gyatvavi moksha say is that you are liberated by knowing something. Krishna doesn't say thus by performing rituals or thus by performing the sacrifices you'll be liberated. He says you'll be liberated by understanding them. So it's not, you have to perform the action, but it's the understanding of what you're doing that actually liberates you. Gyatva. Thus understanding. Edam gyatva. So...
sorry, so like, for example, renouncing meat, knowing that it is, you know, not, pleasing to Krishna, and knowing that and practicing that, that would be one example of many?
You could offer that austerity, that you don't eat meat. It's the knowledge. Krishna says elsewhere in the Gita that anything you do with knowledge is much more powerful than things you do when you don't know what you're doing. But anyway, let's go on. You'll see what Krishna's getting at. So Krishna says that understanding sacrifice, this offering, it's the understanding that will actually liberate you. And then he makes what I consider to be one of the most interesting statements in the Gita. Shreyan dravyamayadya gya gyanadya gya parantapa. Sarvam karma kilam partha gyane parisamapyate. So I'll translate this very literally so we can keep our train of thought going here. Literally, Krishna says that the sacrifice of knowledge, and by that he doesn't mean you give up your knowledge, but what he means is sacrifice or sacrifice in knowledge. A sacrifice, an offering, in which the real point of it is to understand things properly, not a blind ritual, not thinking that if I just move my body in certain ways and, you know, wave incense in the air, or but you're actually performing an offering because you seek understanding. You're actually seeking an understanding, spiritual understanding. And Krishna says that sacrifice is better, Shayan, is better than the sacrifice which consists of material paraphernalia. In all rituals, or, wait, that's too broad, in many rituals, we offer things. You know, there's different, in all the world religions, there are different offerings, and often, for example, things like incense or water or fire, there's just different paraphernalia, different, sometimes they ring bells, and all this in Sanskrit is called dravya, or material paraphernalia. And Krishna says, better than an offering, or food, for example, you make an offering of food, or you make an offering of money. And Krishna, of course, we're not trying to discourage your donations here. I'll get in trouble if I do that. But Krishna's saying that better than the offering of some physical thing is to perform an offering in which you actually open your mind and seek knowledge. Because after all, we can perform all the religious rituals in the world and be in a very strange consciousness. We can do it out of pride, out of fear, out of social pressure. But, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons. There's all kinds of motives for performing some, what looks like some kind of religious ceremony or some offering. And therefore, Krishna says, the sacrifice in which the point is really a true spiritual understanding, that's better. And then Krishna says, interestingly, it's immediately after that statement about the importance of knowledge that Krishna speaks a verse which is very important or very well known among devotees. Tadviti pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadrikshanti te jnanam jnanasatadarshina, which Prabhupada translates, just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively, render service to him, the self-realized souls can impart knowledge to you because they have seen the truth. So what Krishna says here, tad vidhi, vid is the Sanskrit root meaning to know, like our English word wit, or vision. Actually, the English word vision, or even video, come from the Sanskrit vid, or veda, knowledge. So Krishna says, Tadvidhi, know that, Tadvidhi. And so what is that? Krishna says, Tadvidhi, know that. That is that knowledge. That knowledge of sacrifice, that knowledge of connecting yourself with the Absolute Truth, connecting yourself with God by truly spiritual behavior. And spiritual behavior is behavior in which we offer, we give, because God is giving everything to us. And when we reciprocate, then that reciprocity on our part is the offering, the spiritual behavior. And ultimately, one offers oneself, which is ultimately, that's what love is. Love means you offer yourself. You can buy someone flowers or a box of candy. You can have all kinds of sinister motives. However, real love means that you actually give yourself. You actually give yourself. You give yourself to someone who deserves the gift and who actually reciprocates and gives themselves to you. And so you don't lose yourself. It's interesting, the idea of giving yourself, how can you give yourself and not lose yourself? For example, let's say you love someone and you do give them, let's just, simple example, you give them a box of organic, natural, candy or something. So you give someone a box of candy, and so if that person really loves you, the first thing they'll say is, of course, thank you. The second thing is, would you like some? And so when two people really love each other and they offer themselves to each other, they don't lose themselves because the other person isn't going to run away with you. Hijack you or just like, or use you in some way. The other person is giving themselves to you. And so what happens through this mutual giving is that two individuals who might have been alone or separate, all the loneliness that brings, actually become, there's a relationship. It's a relationship. There's, as I always say, there's a new third thing, which is, it can be a couple or a friendship. And so by this mutual giving, because people don't really give each other, it's not really a new single thing. It's still two people just kind of like negotiating and doing whatever they do with each other. So the act of offering, all these offerings, like you may offer a little incense, or before, let's say if you're trained in Krishna consciousness, before you eat, you offer some food. You offer the food to Krishna. Actually, all that is just sort of spiritual practice. Because ultimately, what we are preparing for in all these offerings, we are preparing ourselves to ultimately perform the greatest act of love, which is to offer yourself. Sanskrit is called Atmanivedana. We offer ourselves, and of course Krishna reciprocates perfectly with us. And as Krishna explains in the Gita, we are part of God, we are part of Krishna. That's really amazing, if you think about it, because we all may be the best of friends and all that, but I'm not technically part of you, you're not technically part of me. In a serious metaphysical sense, I don't want to say physically, but to actually be part of someone, in the sense that my existence is part of someone else's existence. Not just in the sense of, you're part of my life, but as a substance. As a spiritual substance, I'm actually part of another spiritual substance. And yet that's the relationship that Krishna explains that we have with Him. We're actually part of Him. So when we open up, when we discover this loving relationship with Krishna, of whom we're part, it's pretty amazing. It really is like going home. Because you finally discover the person that you're part of, with whom you have the most intimate possible relationship, because Krishna's in our heart. I mean, imagine that. There's nothing that you can do to chase Krishna out of your heart. You could curse him, you could rebuke him, you could, just think of every vile thing you could possibly do to chase someone away, and yet Krishna still remains in your heart. So we want to talk about someone hanging in there with you. There's really no one like Krishna. No one like Krishna has proven their commitment to you the way Krishna has. I mean, almost practically everyone else in the world, you can chase them away. You can get so totally out of control and outrageous that you can even chase your parents away under special circumstances. But, you know, it's really amazing how Krishna, he's still there. And he's been with us forever. So, Krishna, no one is as committed to us as Krishna is. No one cares about us as much as Krishna does. I mean, people like and you know the novel Jane Eyre? Anyway, Jane discovers toward the end of the novel that she had a very rich uncle who lived in Madeira. And who left her, a fortune. So, discovering you had an extremely rich uncle that unfortunately passed away and left you a fortune, you know, that can be a good thing. So, but what if you discover that you are intimately connected to someone, you have the most intimate possible connection with someone who actually owns everything, and who's all-powerful, and who really likes you? It's an amazing contact. So Krishna consciousness means that we have this amazing contact. So why not pursue it? Why not pursue this best possible, best imaginable contact we have? And again, the act of offering, when we offer things to Krishna, it's not like, okay, he's some cosmic tyrant and it's like one of those, like, I don't know, like old Hollywood movies where everyone, you know, the slaves in Rome are being whipped and lashed and they have to bow down to the emperor or something, or the pharaoh. It's not like that. When we make offerings to Krishna, we are simply finally waking up and doing what he's been doing for us all along, namely offering us everything. After all, Krishna offers us life, he offers us everything. Everything Krishna is giving us, it's a question of completing a cycle, of reciprocating, of waking up. It's like an infant just takes from the parents, the mother's milk, everything. I mean, the infant just takes. The infant can't give anything, except you could say the pleasure gives the parents. But as a child grows up, hopefully the child learns to reciprocate all the parents have done and to also perform acts of love. So to make offerings to God, to Krishna, simply means we're growing up. We're not acting in an infantile way. We're just, you know, whatever we see, we want to put it in our mouth or in our bank account or somewhere in our pocket. So if you think about a baby, it just, you know, puts everything in its mouth and just grabs everything. And we should not be spiritually infantile. We should come to the point we want to offer to Krishna. There's a beautiful verse, actually, I think in this chapter where Krishna says, evam pravartitam chakram, that a, literally, it's a very beautiful verse, and the literal translation is, that thus a wheel, or a cycle, has been made to turn. Literally, has been made to turn. Evam pravartitam chakram. And nanu vartya tiha jaha, and one who does not keep the wheel turning. Aghayur, their, like Ayurveda, Ayur means your whole duration of life. Their duration of their life is simply an offense. And mogam partha sajivati, that person lives in vain. Indriyaram is simply trying to enjoy their senses. So this wheel that has been made to turn is the wheel of reciprocation. And it's the basis of love, it's the basis of justice, it's really the basis of every virtue. This wheel that is made to turn. And Krishna says, you have to keep the wheel turning. And you keep the wheel turning by taking all these gifts that you're receiving and offering them back. And that keeps the wheel turning. So that's sacrifice. And Krishna says, you learn all this, learn this, know this, pranipatena, by submission. By submission, pariprasnena, by thorough questioning. In other words, it's not blind allegiance. Krishna here says, you learn not just by blindly following, but by inquiring, by investigating things. Ask your questions. And sevaya, by service. Upadekshanti te jnana, jnaninas tatadarshina. Krishna here juxtaposes two words, which in Sanskrit really kind of emphasize the point, where he says, jnanam, jnaninas. So try to translate this literally, or even keeping the same syntax. Krishna says here that they will teach knowledge those who have knowledge. Or they will teach knowledge those who have knowledge. And then those who have knowledge, tattva darshina, those who have seen the truth. Darshina, those who have seen the truth. And the word truth there is also significant, because there are various words in Sanskrit that mean truth. But here the word Krishna uses is tattva. The word tattva. And the word tattva, to give you a sort of a brief explanation, there's a lot to say about the word tattva, it's a very interesting word. Basically it means a fundamental demonstrable truth. Like, for example, the individual soul as a category. The individual soul as a category, an irreducible category of real thing, is called jiva tattva. Or God, or Vishnu, as an irreducible category of real thing is called Vishnu tattva. And so here Krishna says, to see tattva, tattva darshina, means you clearly understand there are souls, there is God, and there is physical nature. And these are all different, but they're all intimately connected, because Krishna is the source of everything. So to see all that, that's what Krishna's talking about, tattva darshina, the seers of the truth. They have knowledge, and so knowledge they'll teach. Those who have knowledge, knowledge will teach. So it's a very interesting verse. Then, what's the result of that knowledge? What happens? If you do what Krishna says, and you do learn this knowledge through submission, service, inquiries, and so on, and those who have knowledge teach you this knowledge, then what happens? So that Krishna explains in the next verse. He says, yajyatva, knowing this, knowing it, you've learned it, so knowing it, na punar moham evam jasasi pandava, you will thus never again fall into illusion. You will never again fall into illusion. And by this, yena, bhutani asheshani drakshasi atmani atomai, you will see all creatures are in the soul, capital S. In other words, in me. So we'll see all creatures in Krishna. The idea being that if we see all creatures in God, no one is available to be seduced, exploited. Isn't it? I mean, for example, I mean, it's like, I mean, to give an example from my generation, which maybe is not applicable anymore because everything's changed and I don't know what's going on out there. But I remember when I was a kid, say a guy went on a date, asked a girl out on a date. So he went to her house. They were sitting together in the living room, and of course, his mind was intensely focused on enjoying her. And so, if her father comes in the room and sits down with a newspaper and says, don't mind me, you young people, just, you know, have a good time there. It's like, oh my God. So, it's So the idea is that when we see every soul, including ourselves, within Krishna, within God, you know, then you're kind of stuck with spiritual behavior. If you really see it that way. And you wouldn't want to exploit someone if you saw this person's actually a divine being. This person is actually part of God. And if you love Krishna and you see this person as part of Krishna, you wouldn't want to exploit them. It's like, for example, even, let's say, the mafia. I spent time in New York. I spent time in Italy, and La Cosa Nostra. It's interesting because if you study sort of mafia sociology, which you can also see in all those great, you know, Hollywood movies, there's a whole genre of mafia movies. And, you know, a mafioso, he may be doing all kinds of things to all kinds of people, but, you know, his own family is different because that's the family. So in the same way, even though we may be inclined to exploit, to try to enjoy other people rather than serve them, when we see everyone within God, it's, and you really love Krishna, and you really understand God, then you want to serve everyone, and that mentality of trying to enjoy other people, and I mean, whether it's sexual domination or you know, the conquest, it's like this famous psychology where, let's say, like the male, he wants to get the girl, and, you know, like sort of bragging rights, and then, you know, once he's conquered the girl, okay, you know, who's the next one now? Because it's the conquest. And of course, this mentality also may be there in a girl. It's like, it's the conquest. Once I got the trophy, I go for another trophy. So, because I already won that one. So the idea here is that it's not really a very healthy mentality. It's not a healthy way to see other life forms, other living beings, to see them as just like trophies, something to conquer. And or sexual exploitation, financial exploitation, political domination, psychological domination, you know, to be sort of like a psychological bully in the sense of, in relationships, just trying to kind of keep people down. In various ways, you know, people can do that. Maybe the boss wants, you know, derive some kind of sick pleasure in keeping down the people under him or her. There's all kinds of ways in which people, because of their own sick mentality, try to dominate other people. And ultimately, as pure souls, the last thing in the world we'd ever want to do is dominate anyone. I mean, why would I want to dominate anyone if everyone is part of God? Sexually, financially, politically, in any way. Why would you want to dominate someone else, another soul? Because if you see spiritually, then you see that all souls are one. I mean, we're individual souls, but we're all the same quality. And you really don't make that distinction between yourself and others because we're all the same thing. We're all just souls. I mean, think again. Let's say there's a really tight team. Team, it's like whether it's a military team that's really in the trenches together, sports team, an actual family. It's really all for one and one for all. It really is like that. In Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all. And so we, even in the material world, we sometimes experience a state of consciousness in which we do not really see ourselves or want to be better than others. We really just are into the team. And the glory is for the team. The victory is for the team. The problem with that is the team is only some people and excludes most everyone else. So when you see all living beings as one team, one family, then you don't want to exploit anyone. And the only entity that can pull that off, pull that together, you know, what would have to be true? What would have to be true in order for you to legitimately see all living beings as one single team or family? There would have to be supreme parents. And that's Radha Krishna. So, it's this Krishna consciousness, which really also is the antidote for exploitation. Anyway, so then, then we'll just get back to the verse we started on and stop there. Oh, then Krishna, now Krishna's going to talk more about knowledge. Abhichet, even if. Abhicheta si papevyak sarvevyak papakritama, even if you are the greatest of all sinners. Even if you are the greatest of all sinners. Sarvam jnana plave naiva vrijinam santarishasi. This whole disaster, that you're the greatest of all sinners, this whole problem, you will cross over simply with the boat of knowledge. And imagine if you're like lost at sea, and here's the boat, the rescue boat that will take you across these turbulent waters. And that boat is knowledge. Knowledge. Knowledge will take you across all your problems. If we really see things properly, there is no problem. The problem is that we're not seeing things properly. The problem is, you know, Matilda doesn't love me anymore. Or the problem isn't that I don't have this, or the problem that I do have, I'm stuck with that. The problem is just that we don't understand. And once we understand reality, who we really are, what's really going on, there actually is no problem. Because the reality is we are perfect spiritual beings, when we're not messing up, and we exist in a world far beyond this world. Far beyond this world. It's like when you go to a foreign country and travel. I know I've done a lot of international traveling. I'm going to do some more actually pretty soon. And so I know that when I go to different countries, wherever it is in the world, I really am not that interested in the local news. Because sometimes you look at a newspaper and I just sort of immediately turn to the international section because, you know, it's just like one of the main things in the world. Because like all the local stuff, you know, taxes and political intrigue, this and that, because I'm not from there. And it's just, you know, it's just local stuff. So we're just visiting this planet, actually. We're just visiting here. And we're not going to stay forever, so... Anyway, so Krishna says the boat of knowledge, then yathai, another metaphor, yathai dansi sabi dognir, Basmasa kurute arjuna, gyanagni sarva karmani basmasa kurute tata. Just as a blazing fire turns firewood to ashes, Arjuna, so the fire of knowledge. Burns to ashes all of our karmic reactions. So knowledge is a boat that takes you over the troubled waters. Knowledge is a fire that burns up all the trash, that burns up all of the karmic reactions, which is going to drag us all over the universe. You know, it's like sort of being, you know, dragged behind, you know, the bumper of someone's pickup truck. So, knowledge is a fire that's going to burn all that up. And then the verse we just read today, so there's nothing. Krishna says there is nothing as purifying in this world as knowledge. Because what is impurity? It's being in the wrong consciousness. It's being like lusty, like because lusty means I want to enjoy someone else's body. I mean, that's kind of bizarre if you think about it. Like, I want to enjoy someone else's body. It's their body. And they're not their body. It's almost like going walking up to someone and just like grabbing their sweater and just like, you know, lusting over their sweater. It's like, what are you doing? So the body is just the covering of the soul. The body is just the covering of the soul. So, Krishna says there's nothing as purifying as knowledge. Knowledge. Because when you really understand things, then you're in pure consciousness. And that by itself, that when a person is personally perfected in yoga, they enjoy that knowledge in time, within themselves, kalena, in time. So you have to be a little patient, and then you, within yourself, you enjoy that knowledge. And then Krishna says, Shadavan Lavate Jnana. One who has faith gets knowledge. For example, I'm going to take a trip to Australia, apparently, later this year. We have a very beautiful place called Govinda's Valley. It's a south of Sydney. It's a very beautiful spiritual retreat center that the devotees have, which is famous now in Australia. And it's in sort of in this mountain valley on the beach. And it's really beautiful. And so I'm going to spend some time there. And I believe it's a really nice place. I believe I can do some service there. And so if I actually believe that and go there, then I'll experience it. So if you think about it, there's... you have to some extent, you have to just feel, yeah, this is the right thing, so let me try to do this. Let me try to do this. And then Krishna says, if you do, if you try to be Krishna conscious, you'll get the knowledge. It will turn into knowledge. Sometimes it's catch-22, like, I can't do it unless I know it, but I can't know it unless I do it. So that's not really a problem, because you can do a little bit. It's like, I mean, let's say, for example, you go to the restaurant, you see something there, and it's not an issue like, is it poisoned or not? Like, that's not the issue. You know, the issue is just, well, is this really, am I going to like this? So just take a little bite, see if you like it. Or if you want to test the water, put your toe in the water. It is true that you got to do it to get the knowledge, but you need the knowledge before you can do it. So, you know, you just do a little bit. You're not risking anything. You're not, I mean, what's going to happen? If we don't buy into kind of like this voodoo theology where people are going to be tortured forever if they choose the wrong church or something. I mean, you know, if we can just sort of put aside that kind of madness, then there's really no risk. And so you try it. We try chanting Hare Krishna. We experience that it is sublime. It is wonderful. Krishna's really there. And then we just naturally increase as we get more and more knowledge. Anyway, probably said enough. Any questions on these points? Yes?
Maharaj, you were talking about knowledge. And I don't know if I have this correct, but in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that it's in the performance of devotional service that I give the knowledge by which you can come to me.
Mm. Yeah, that's in the chapter... 10. Teshang satata jukta nam bhajatam priti purukam dadami. I give. Dadami buddhi yogam tam jina mama pajanti te.
So I guess my question is, to what extent is knowledge something we can gather, and to what extent is knowledge a gift from God?
It's sort of both. It's interesting, you know, there's danger at both ends in terms of going to philosophical extremes. And I'll give you an example of a philosophical extreme which astonishes me, but some people seem to chronically go to that extreme. It's what I call hyper-piety. In other words, someone in their devotion to God is so anxious to give all the credit to God and to humble themselves before God that they say that, and then, I mean, we're talking about Augustine, we're talking about Calvin, we're talking about even some people and some Vaishnavas, that my salvation, or the fact that I discovered this knowledge, the fact that I now, that I've entered into a relationship with God, this is purely God's mercy. I did nothing to deserve it. Sometimes devotees... some people kind of slip into that, like, causeless mercy. Now, you've heard this term. I mean, the term causeless mercy is, I mean, technically, it's an emphatic redundancy. It also, I mean, we use it a lot, but it's actually not there in the Sanskrit. There is no Sanskrit term in the scriptures that literally means causeless mercy. And actually, so I'm not saying it's wrong or it's a bad term, but we have to understand it, what it means and what it doesn't mean. Mercy, the English word mercy, or the equivalent in any other language, means that, in a sense, it's not just quid pro quo. It's not, there's no cause. Like a typical example of mercy you find in a dictionary is that the judge put aside the law and gave mercy to the accused. In other words, if you give someone what they deserve, that's not mercy. It's just you're giving them what they deserve, what they earned, either punishment or reward or whatever. So the word mercy means that it's not just giving someone what they're supposed to get, it's being merciful. So an example of misinterpreting causeless mercy is sort of the extreme humility of saying, how did I become a devotee or how did I discover Krishna? I did absolutely nothing to deserve it. It was just completely causeless mercy. The problem with that view is that it leads to a monstrous corollary, which is that God, contrary to what he says in the Bhagavad Gita, is not really fair to everyone, is not really equal to everyone, because if you are totally undeserving and you receive God's mercy, what about someone else who is totally undeserving that didn't get the mercy? Yet what Krishna says in the Gita is samoham sarvabhutesha, I'm equal to all creatures. So if Krishna gives mercy to one totally undeserving person, why wouldn't he give it to everyone? Because the worst you can get is totally undeserving, right? I mean, what's worse than totally undeserving? So Krishna does reciprocate. Krishna says that, jajata, Krishna reciprocates. So in answer to your question, I mean, think when you're raising a child. Obviously, let's say good parents, they love their children. They want to do everything for their children. And yet, it's not good for the children to spoil them. It's not good for the children to overlook all their faults and give them things they don't deserve, because the children actually end up being spoiled. In California, they had the great self-esteem movement in the public schools years ago, where, you know, basically, nothing that the children ever did was wrong or bad, right? I'm not saying that what you did is wrong or bad, or whatever answer they gave. No, I'm not saying your answer is wrong. However, you know, why don't you look at it? So what was the result of this great self-esteem movement in the California public schools? They just ruined a generation of children. Because the studies show that when they got out into the real world's not like that. I mean, some things are really wrong. And some things are really bad. And so it turned out not to be an act of kindness to keep them in this little, you know, cartoon world. So if you love someone, you're merciful to them, but you insist that they earn certain things because that's good for them. Because it's healthy to teach people that there is a reasonable relationship between what you do and the consequences. So anyway, so it's Krishna's mercy, but it's also eternal. Yes?
Thank you, Maharaj, for just clicked right with me with what you were saying about saying that Krishna's, my involvement with Krishna is God's mercy. There's a tinge of vanity to that. But as you were saying, with those who are without, then why am I so special, etc. So in the context of that, that kind of maybe OCD done, Swami once told me,
who? OCD?
I may be OCD.
Oh, you may be, okay.
A Swami once told me, you know, I'm 6 foot huge, and you know, he looked at me and said, always be as humble as a blade of grass. So when you discuss Krishna consciousness with people, which I'm very apt to doing, never bores me, what advice would you give to being humble, but owning the fact that, yes, I discovered Krishna. And it's our birthright. So it is.
Well, humility can just mean you're very enthusiastic about Krishna. I'm not very enthusiastic. I'm not trying to promote myself. I really love Krishna. Krishna's great. I want to tell you about Krishna because he's so great. Simple. Yes?
So is it true, offering the self, that one can promote this sacrificial knowledge or sacrificial performances, and that by increasing this sacrificial knowledge, that one creates this sacrificial character within or on the inner circle?
Well, like for example, I mean, Krishna is such a great guy. That, let's say you go to the restaurant just to have a really tasty meal, he counts that as a sacrifice. You know, you're up on the scoreboard just by eating. Or if you, like here, you know, I'm having a lot of fun just talking to you. It's like, you know, it's just a lot of fun. Sit around with nice people and talk about Krishna, and I get points for this. Or Sham. Sham is doing this very important program, outreach program. And he gets lots of points for that. So that's the beauty of Krishna consciousness. We can do all these enjoyable services, and Krishna accepts them as sacrifice. So it's kevala ananda kanda. It's very blissful. Krishna says in the Gita, susukam kartum avyayam. Very joyfully performed. In answer to your question, Krishna in chapter 9 gives a very important statement. He says, jat karoshi, whatever you do, jatashnasi, whatever you eat, jeju hoshi, whatever you sacrifice, dadasi, whatever you give in charity, jatapasyasi kunte, whatever austerity you perform, tat kurusha mararpanam, make that an offering to me. So if you like to sing, Gino likes to sing, don't you?
You want that loud?
Yeah,
I do like to sing.
You must sing in the shower too.
Sometimes.
So, I mean, you know, if we like to sing, if you like to dance, if you like to eat well, if you like to talk to people, if you like to do art, if you like to work, if you like to write, if you like to build things or do business, it's like whatever you like to do, Krishna is not saying, you know, torture yourself, deny yourself. No. He's saying do what's natural for you. But make that your offering. It's like that great song, you know, this is dedicated to the one I love. So, you know that song? Oh my God. No one knows that song?
Yeah.
No, that's it.
Yeah. So, that's all you do. Whatever you do, at the end of it, just add, this is dedicated to the one I love. You know, Krishna. And whoever else you love, they're part of Krishna. So, no one's left out. Everyone's invited to the party. You know, whoever you love, they're part of Krishna. So if you love Krishna, it'll only increase your love for other people. In the material world, there's this whole jealousy thing, and triangles, and quadrangles, and pentangles, and everything. So, and just total messes. So the idea is that in this world, you could say, well, you're my family, so you're not my family, or, you know, I'm sorry, John, but, you know, it's going with Fred or something. Oh God, my head is so full of 60s pop songs. I could give some lyrics for every philosophical point I want to make, but I won't. So they're good messages. Anyway, the idea is that in the case of Krishna, there's no question of, okay, sorry, I can't really love you because I love Krishna. Because everyone's part of Krishna. And so you love Krishna, you learn to truly love everyone. Not just be partners in crime with someone in the name of love. But to truly love someone. So just do everything for Krishna. I mean, why not? Krishna's saying, whatever your nature is, you know, make that your career. If it's something, I mean, obviously we don't want to be butchers or whatever, but any decent occupation, art, business, teaching, you know, whatever, just whatever you do, just do that for Krishna. Just dedicate it to the one you love. Just love Krishna. Because whatever you do with your body, with your mind. And those are all gifts of Krishna. So it's perfectly natural that whatever you do with these gifts, the body, the mind, and so on, whatever you do with these gifts, you offer it back to the one who gave them to you. And you offer it back, you get more. It's like in the entire history of the Hare Krishna movement, there's not a single known case where someone put the food on the altar and bowed down and sat up and it was gone. Right? There's not a single known case that someone offered their food to Krishna and he actually just... And then when the person got up again, there was no food left, and they just heard a loud burp coming from the altar. That never happens. So as they say, on the analogy of food, so just as when you put food on the altar, Krishna actually, you know, he accepts it and then leaves it there for you in an exalted form. The food gets better. By offering food to Krishna, you don't starve. You eat better than you would if you didn't offer it. And in the same way, that's true for everything. That's true for... It's not just food. It's relationships. It's art. It's everything. Every aspect of life, if you truly offer to Krishna, Krishna will give it back to you in a better form. Food is just... an example, but it's true for everything. Yes?
Earlier you were speaking about knowledge. Could you define for me, perhaps I'm pronouncing it wrong, Jnana Yoga?
Yeah, that's okay. It's interesting how in India they pronounce JN as Gya. Like in Italy they pronounce GN as Nya, like lasagna. They don't say lasagna. Anyway. So, you want me to define knowledge, that word, or
Well, Jnana Yoga?
Jnana Yoga. Yeah, it's yoga which is based on the pursuit of knowledge.
Right, and if you could, for some, tie that in with, I mean, that's it, as you were saying earlier about yoga, the importance of knowledge. Yes. The importance of knowledge. And
but it's interesting because Jnana Yoga, like throughout the teachings of the Acharyas and even in the Bhagavatam, is considered to be less than Bhakti Yoga in this sense. There is a certain pleasure that comes from being intellectual, from reading lots of books, having a great library, and even that becomes a type of... In other words, when we practice Bhakti Yoga, we get knowledge, we get oceanic knowledge. However, trying to gratify oneself intellectually or literarily is still not pure love. I mean, in a state of pure... It's not that we shouldn't read books, it's not that we shouldn't be intellectual, but again, even that, you can pursue intellectuality, you can pursue high culture, so to speak, in a mood of service. It's interesting when Krishna, that famous Shikshastika verse spoken by Lord Chaitanya, that Nadanam Najanam Nasundarim, I don't desire wealth, nor followers, jana. Nasundarim, nor do I seek to enjoy a beautiful woman. And then he says, kavitam va. And kavitam actually means intellectuality. So in the list of things that Lord Chaitanya said he doesn't want to like enjoy selfishly, one of them is kavita. The word kavi means a scholar, poet, and then kavita. Intellectuality.
But don't they go hand in hand? I mean, bhakti and the jnana? I mean, once...
Yes, because the Bhagavatam says that Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Priyojita, when you perform devotional service to Krishna sincerely, janayati ashu vairagyam jnanam chajara haitukam, that loving service that you're rendering quickly produces the jnana, the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the verse that someone else here quoted, that that Krishna gives you the knowledge. So when you render loving service to Krishna, he'll give you the highest knowledge.
Yes. But and that's, for me, personally, that's through Swami Prabhupada's books.
Yes.
For me personally. That's how...
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably for most of us. And then we realize it. Because Prabhupada is saying in his books, serve Krishna. And so if we take that seriously, if we read Prabhupada's books and actually follow them, then the knowledge we read becomes more and more realized.
Yes,
yes.
When you were talking about offering things to Krishna and all that, I'm just trying to figure out how that practically works. In other words, somebody's maybe teaching something, or teaching fencing at the college or whatever, and they're trying to figure out, well, or maybe I can't be full-on devoted to God right now, but I want to bring God into my life. So, I mean, of course, we have the example of putting the food on the altar and things like that, or maybe you make some money, right. So you just put that on the altar and then take it back and, you know, just go on with your life. You know, is that...
Put the money on the altar and then take it back. Watch out.
Well, yeah, it's prasadam now, right? So I can use it any way I want. I'm just trying to get, like, more sort of practical insight on
that. Yeah, that's good. Devil's in the details. So, Sandamani, what do you advise? What's your advice for the fencing teacher? The fencing teacher is a good. What would you advise the fencing teacher?
Use the knife to cut vegetables.
Yeah, that's good.
Remember something, okay?
I would say, first of all, assuming that the fencing teacher is working for a salary, obviously, the fencing teacher has to rent or buy an apartment or house, and you could make that a place for Krishna. So if you're working and being paid, and you use the money to construct for yourself a Krishna-conscious life, or you give money to others that are preaching and so on, then the work is somehow drawn into devotional service. And if one does one's work very excellently, like for what did I saw a billboard in Tucson where a quote-unquote great basketball player is recommending that you not send text messages while you drive. And who would know more about road safety than a basketball player? Right? Who would know more about shaving than a baseball player? So, they probably know more about spitting and chewing tobacco, but not necessarily shaving. So, anyway, the point here is that when people achieve excellence in something, other people sort of generally admire them. And so whatever we do as devotees, rather than just sort of being lukewarm, well, I don't really care about this because this is not really Krishna conscious, in a sense, we can really be good at what we do, do it with real devotion for Krishna, become excellent at it, and then naturally we'll be in a position in which people will listen to us, even if it's fencing. And then your other question about putting money on the altar, but you don't get to take it back.
Or you do get to take it back and then kind of do whatever you want because now it's prasad.
Well, it's interesting. You see, in the fourth chapter, when Krishna describes different sacrifices, the fire is the recipient of the offering. And then, in the various sacrifices he describes, there are different recipients. For example, sometimes it's the fire that receives the offering. Sometimes the senses receive the offering, the sense objects. The mind may receive the offering, the controlled senses, and so on. So, in the case of, let's say, food, the altar is placed on the altar. That's the recipient. So, for each type of sacrifice, the question is, what's the recipient? And so in the case of money, I mean, obviously you can't, offerings have to be done intelligently. For example, let's say you make a little food offering at home and you offer things that are so rich that you die young. You basically are self-destructing because you think, I mean, Krishna likes his food and I'm going to eat the offering, but it's not very healthy. And there's actually a myth that Krishna doesn't like healthy food. But anyway, so the offering has to be made intelligently. The offering has to be made intelligently. So if you're spending your money for Krishna, in other words, you can't just take your money and throw it up in the air and say, take it, Krishna, and why didn't it come back? You know, so, I mean, offerings have to be made intelligently. So If you want to spend your money for Krishna, you have to do it intelligently. And if you do it in a serious, proper way, then yeah, you won't be a loser for it.
Thank you.
So then we'll stop here. I'd like to thank you all very much for hanging in there. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Vidyananda Das Goswami Ki.